Today we cover a necessary tool for decoding Twin Peaks Season 3. It's an iconic book written by Mark Frost, and it's called The Secret History of Twin Peaks. And what you'll hear today is my brief recap of the book, which will confirm that Twin Peaks Season 1 and Season 2 are connected to the occult. The story starts way back with Lewis and Clark, who meet the Nez Perce tribe, who provide the backstory on the Twin Peaks Jade Ring and the entrance to the Black Lodge. From here, we learn about the history of the U.S. government's control and psychological operations regarding UFOs, including secret societies like the Freemasons and the Illuminati. Mark Frost walks us through the story of Douglas Milford, who connects a lot of the dots between the Roswell crash, the Trinity atomic bomb testing, Jack Parsons opening up gateways with Aleister Crowley and L. Ron Hubbard, sex, magic, and so much more. We learn about the various UFO conspiracies, Maury Island, Majestic 12, Project Sign, Project Grudge, Project Blue Book, which leads us back into Twin Peaks and Glastonbury Grove. We'll revisit the theories from the synchromystic himself, James Shelby Downer, who gave us the true occult story of the JFK death ritual, the desert portals of Alamogordo, Hornada del Muerte, where the alchemical destruction of primordial matter happened. He said that all things hidden must be revealed, and that's what we're going to do today. Now, of course, you're in the Grey Lodge with your host, Isaac Weishaupt. Today, we are digging deeper into the world of Twin Peaks. And with all the things I talked about in the intro, we also are going to catch up with several characters from Twin Peaks since the, you know, series finale of Season 2 back in 1990. We're going to catch up with Audrey Horne, Pete and Catherine Martell, Andrew Packard, Hank Jennings, and many more. And we even get some backstories on some of these characters in this book. And this book is actually what really puts a lot of these pieces together. And spoiler warning, this could reveal some major plot lines from Season 1, Season 2, and Fire Walk With Me. I would strongly advise that if you haven't watched those episodes and that movie, you start over at Season 1, Episode 1, the pilot, I should say, Episode 0. And you'll notice this is on the free feed, this episode, because I wanted... Look, because as you know, I started this Grey Lodge series where we deep dive into Twin Peaks every single episode, every single piece of work from this universe. And if you are new to the journey, I'm telling you, you got to start the pilot. I'm telling you right now. But the reason I'm posting this on the free feed is because I know some people out there started down the Twin Peaks journey with me. They were in the Grey Lodge with me and they bailed at some point. Understandable, because guess what? I did it myself a couple times. So this is your chance. I'm going to re-tantalize you with this book that this is red-hot occultism. And it's going to be amazing. This book is amazing. This book was released October 18th, 2016, which was before Season 3 started, I believe. And what it is it's a... I've got all the versions. I've got the audiobook, I've got the hardcover, and I've got the Kindle version. So... the one I would recommend if you got the time is the hardcover. And it's not a cheap book, but when you get it, you'll see why, because there's tons of illustrations. It's very beautifully done. It's a beautiful book. In fact, I'm mad because the copy I bought, these doofuses mailed it with a barcode sticker they taped on at their store or whatever. I'm like, bro, what are you doing? Anyway. But what it is, it's a book that is basically the dossier of notes compiled by this unnamed archivist, which you find out by the end who the archivist is. And what it is a dossier of notes about all the things I talked about already, the history of Twin Peaks and all this stuff. And there's an FBI special agent that goes by TP that makes notes in the margins and is reviewing this for Gordon Cole. And you also find out who that is by the end. And the whole time, TP is trying to determine who the archivist is and so on. Now, this book will go through the history of Twin Peaks and the area with some major character backgrounds and revelations. And the reason we're going through it is because this book actually confirms all of the occult suspicions we've had all along. It really does. It wraps up some of the questions remaining from Season 2 and prepares you for Season 3. Now, I have to know there are some continuity errors within the book and the Twin Peaks official canon. Mark Frost said that this was on purpose because sometimes historical documents do have errors. So, you know, and like I said, this is going to be a brief run through. If you want to dig deeper, there's a lot more in this book. And a lot of it surrounds Doug Milford, which was a very minor character that we only met in season two for like two episodes. Remember, he was the mayor's brother and he marries Lana. Well, Doug Milford, you know, he's a hot mess, but then he joins the Air Force and he ends up going to the Trinity site in Roswell for the crash. And then he's part of Project Blue Book and all this stuff. And this is his journey, is most of the dossier. And he's the one that ends up having Major Briggs take over for the research that's being done at Twin Peaks. Now, the book itself, tons of illustrations, and it's fun because these illustrations actually have hidden images. I didn't know that the first couple times I read it. I read it maybe three times. And apparently, if you wear red and blue glasses, which I have them in my cart, I'm going to order them. I just haven't done it yet. Apparently, if you wear red and blue glasses, you can see different aspects of the image, like there's buried subconscious images in there. Some you can cover just the red, some you can cover just the blue, which ties us into Dr. Jacoby's theory about suppressing the logic or the intuition. We'll get into that later. For instance, there is, I'll give you one example. There's an image in here of, for no good ass reason, the Bookhouse Boys, right? You know the Bookhouse Boys. They have their favorite books listed in this beautiful image. It takes up two pages. And it's interesting because there's a blog called WelcomeToTwinPeaks.com, a very good blog. And it lays out this whole mystery where this guy named Aaron Mento was looking at the book and he read in the archivist notes on the margins, it says different things like, good literature is a mirror through which we see ourselves more clearly, and much can be learned in unexpected places. So Aaron takes the book, puts it up to the mirror, realizes that the numbering of the books, it's numbered 1 through 11, that the number 1 is replaced with the Roman numeral, the capital I, all right? And Aaron thinks, well, symmetrically, the I, which is 1, and the II, which is 11, the 1 and the 11, as well as the number 8, those are all symmetrical when you look at them in the mirror. Everything else is backwards. So he takes the first word of the books 1, 8, and 11 and puts them together, and it spells out Fear the Double. And book 8 is actually Cooper's favorite book, which is about JFK, by the way. And it's a message. And we're gonna come back to that later and just, what the heck are we talking about? Fear the Double. It actually means something. Now, the audiobook is also very well done. A lot of characters and cast come back, like Cheryl Lee plays Laura, which I don't remember because I haven't listened to the audiobook in a while. But anyway, Michael Horst plays Hawk. Mark Frost plays Dr. Hayward. David Patrick Kelly plays Gordon Cole. Yeah, that's right. Not David Lynch. That's all right, though. It's okay. It's all right. Kyle MacLachlan plays Cooper, Chris Mulkey plays Hank, and Russ Tamblyn as Dr. Jacoby. A lot of these people recur, reprising their roles on the show. So it starts out, let's just get into it. Starts out, there's a letter from Gordon Cole directed at the special agent TP. And what we're looking at is how this is a whole dossier recovered on July 17th, 2016 from a metal lockbox from a crime scene that's under investigation. It's classified three levels above top secret. And it's all about the events that happen at Twin Peaks and lays the foundation for season three, as you know. I believe, and I don't know this because I haven't got into, I'm excited to get into season three, but I'm pretty sure that the crime scene they're talking about shows up in season three. I could be wrong. We'll see. Now, the book spine has a large, on the dossier, has a large fragmented pyramid in a triangle shape, and they note it in the book, and it's got different symbols from season one and season two, like the three vertical diamonds, right down the center, which Cooper was drawing on the napkin. And underneath the big triangle is a sort of upward and downward triangle together, like an as above, so below symbol. So anyways, now we get into the dossier. This is the whole crux of this whole thing. And it starts out with Lewis and Clark. Yes, we're going back to 1805. Can you believe it? And it's all about Lewis and Clark traveling west to locate the Northwest Passage to the Pacific. You know, that's the original title of the Twin Peaks show originally, wasn't it? Or the pilot? And they meet the Nez Perce tribe out in Washington at around Twin Peaks area, right? And there's a letter from Lewis to President Jefferson, and he talks about the Nez Perce chief named Twisted Hair. And Twisted Hair talks to Lewis about this ring that they received from whites in that area. Now, the whites in the area, the implication here is that we're talking about aliens. We're talking about the integrated ascended masters or the Nordics. You know, in Blavatsky's world, which is there's a lot of theosophy baked into Twin Peaks. The integrated ascended masters are kind of like the Nordics, the white folk. Now, this ring, it's described as having basically the White Lodge symbol. There's even an image in the book. I'll try to put the images on the Instagram. But it's the symbol with the leg sort of upright. And the chief even turns it upside down and says something about an owl and how it's connected to the spirit world. The translator can't seem to make sense of it. But Twisted Hair gives it to Lewis, the ring, inside of a pouch. And he says, you better keep this in the pouch, buddy. Don't you take it out. So Lewis, he heads out in the woods, leaves Clark behind to, you know, whittle canoes or whatever. And then we hear about, and the book kind of jumps around. So I'm actually doing a pretty good service here of trying to wrap up the major themes of the book. Then Thomas Jefferson writes in his own journal about the Freemasons, the Illuminati, and the paranormal, and the ideas that Jefferson sent them out there to research these things. Because Lewis and Clark, they were both high-ranking Freemasons. Lewis goes out with the tribe, and he goes to this mysterious place, and it's described, it sounds like the Red Room. And later on in Jefferson's journal, he describes it with a place full of music and silvery spheres and fires that burn but do not consume, colors of gold. But anyways, Lewis freaks out, comes back, keeps the ring. He's going to keep the ring. They always do. They can't resist. And eventually Lewis comes back east, and he's appointed governor of the Upper Louisiana Territory. He starts the St. Louis Masonic Lodge and becomes the master of the lodge. And at some point he goes mad and sort of becomes an alcoholic. Meanwhile, Clark gets initiated into the Masons and founds the Missouri Lodge and all this. And in Jefferson's letter, he talks about two esoteric groups trying to control the future of America. You got the Freemasons, which he describes as good, and the Illuminati, which he describes as selfish and bad and evil. He says that the Illuminati are interested only in enriching its elite class at the expense of the general populace. Then the book details the actual death of Lewis, either a suicide or a murder. It's actually unknown. The book is mostly true. There's some spins on it to make it relevant to the Twin Peaks universe, but a lot of it's true. He was acting strange that night, apparently, and the dossier, of course, claims he was talking about the ring. Because you remember, he kept the ring. He dies and they find the pouch, but there's no ring in the pouch. And it was believed to have been stolen from Major Neely. But Jefferson was apparently interested in races of giants and all this paranormal stuff out west, and that was part of the reason why he secretly sent Lewis and Clark, okay? And, you know, Lewis, he would later go on to research at the American Philosophy Society about alchemy and paranormal stuff and all this. So that was the secret mission. and he got the ring. That's where the iconic ring breaks loose into the world. Next, the next section is about the history of the town of Twin Peaks. The archivist details the history of the area. And there's pages from a journal that talks about Owl Cave. And there was a journal retrieved in the woods and stored in a Freemason lodge. And, you know, this made me think about the New Mexico Trinity site, which we're going to come up back to later. There is, in Paulo Harris's book, Trinity, and Jacques Vallée, they talk about how the people that went to the Trinity site used to go to this diner that was close by. It was called the Owl Cafe, which I thought was very strange. But in the book, they talk about the Illuminati using the owl as the logo. So Mark Frost wants us to know this owl is connected to Illuminati symbolism. We hear about two prominent families starting up the town of Twin Peaks, basically, the Packards and the Martells. They had these competing sawmills, started just wrecking the land. And there was, on February 24th, 1902, the night of the Burning River, there was a fire that decimated the area. The book wonders if it was a calamity or a curse. Now take note, February 24th, that's the day that Laura Palmer was murdered. And apparently in 1902, 87 years prior, they had a fire that was, you know, whatever. The nature fighting back against man. One of the themes we saw with the opening credits of Twin Peaks, remember? With the sawmill. Then we fast forward, now it's May 14th, 1927. Scoutmaster Dwayne Milford, he was only 21. He's the old guy, he's the mayor in the TV show. He took the Boy Scouts, which included Andrew Packard. He was 16 at the time. He's also a Freemason in the book. And takes them camping out in Ghostwood at the Pearl Lakes. And we all know bad stuff happens at Pearl Lakes. This is where Leland met Bob, which earlier in that found journal, there was talk about a Denver Bob disappearing after messing around in that area. It made me think, is that Bob? Did a spirit inhabit Denver Bob? And then you got the Denver airport, which is full of alien symbolism. I mean, it's just, you could nerd out on this book for days. So they find the scouts, the Boy Scouts, they go out and they find the circle of trees, which obviously it's Glastonbury Grove. They smell the burning oil from the black sludge. And there's a ghost story about a one-armed man. I mean, this is all obvious, right? They even see a giant 7-foot man. Again, we know where this is coming from. But the article wraps up with Andrew Packard quoting Shakespeare's Hamlet. He says, "There's more in heaven and earth than is dreamt up in our philosophy." Which, if you recall, that's what Major Briggs says in Season 2, Episode 9. But the point is that there's some supernatural activity, and Dwayne Milford, Andrew Packard, they all saw it. And you'll find that as a theme in the book. A lot of people grew up in Twin Peaks. All this paranormal stuff is nothing new. Then we get into Douglas Milford. This is a big chunk of the main part of the dossier. He leaves Twin Peaks during the Depression, ends up joining the Army in 1941, gets in trouble for stealing while he's stationed at Guam in 1944, gets the special attachment assignment to Alamogordo in 1945. We're talking about New Mexico, White Sands range. And he was a part of the Manhattan Project at this point, right? And Alamogordo, this opens up that can of worms with James Shelby Downard, which we talked about a couple of times in the Season 1 and maybe even Season 2, with the synchromysticism idea. Because Alamogordo is, of course, where the Trinity test happened. And fun fact, it's also where Atari buried 700,000 copies of the E.T. game. An alien game buried in Alamogordo? I don't know. Connected? Strange, for sure. And Spielberg comes up later in this book, by the way. But Alamogordo, it's down by Holloman Air Force Base, which is where Eisenhower supposedly met the aliens. We'll get into that later. but this is where Kenneth Bainbridge coordinated the Trinity tests at the Alamogordo bombing and gunnery range. And this is another downward rabbit hole, because he's big into this whole thing of Baines when it comes to like Lyndon Baines Johnson. And he has all the synchromysticism that connects LBJ with Macbeth from Shakespeare and McBird, and it's pretty wild. But and I think he said JFK was born on like Bain Street. Anyway, but the Alamogordo bombing and gunnery range where the Trinity test happened, the week before the bomb went off, they renamed it White Sands Proving Ground. Why? I don't know. But it's near Socorro, New Mexico, and it's in the Jornada del Muerte Desert, which we talked about in the past. Now, James Shelby Downard, and this is the theme I want to relay to you from the world of Twin Peaks. He talked about how the JFK Killing of the King ritual is symbolized in alchemy through the destruction of primordial happen. primordial matter. And his whole shtick with that was all that is hidden must be revealed. Okay. And JFK is the ritual of rituals, and it's very much part of the Trinity atomic test. Mankind conducting these experiments, matter being destroyed at the Trinity site as primordial matter. And it's sort of the opposite of the Greek Heros Gamos idea of creation and unification of opposing polarities that created the world, right? So you have the sacred marriage that creates, and there the destruction of primordial matter that destroys. And it's the liberation of primordial energy versus the sacred divorce, they call it. But anyways, Downard was big into this idea of these antagonistic opposing forces of male and female, good and evil, and how the balance of these things gets equalized, right? The force, you got to balance the force through transference rituals like the Killing of the King ritual and sex and death and all kinds of stuff. But I think that's what the whole obsession with JFK is from Cooper and why you see it in the show so often. Because it ties us into James Shelby Downard, because the locations that keep getting brought up, and we'll see him again in season 3. So Doug Milford, he's in Roswell in July of 1947, and of course he witnesses the UFO crash, and he ends up getting interviewed by the military, and he talks about how he saw General Nathan Twining at the Roswell crash. Now, if you recall, in season 2, episode 13, we talked about this whole thing, about the lineage of these UFO studies, Project Sign, which was started in 1947 after Twining requested it. And then we talked about the Doolittle twins in season 2, episode 19, because Pete Martel knew them on Guam, which is where Milford got in trouble. And this is where Pete Martel saw that box, the puzzle box. And Doolittle had gone to Roswell to meet with James Goddard in 1938. And Eisenhower had him report to the CIA, and Doolittle was a 33rd degree Mason. All these people are very closely affiliated. So anyway, Milford sees the UFO crash at Roswell, and this is the beginning of his new career being sort of in the X-Files, right? To put it bluntly. He's been, ever since then, he's in the world of intelligence and UFOs and all that, and he gets sent back to Twin Peaks eventually, which is where he lays the foundation for Major Briggs. Then the book, the dossier, goes back to the history of UFOs in America and Kenneth Arnold. And this is, if you already know UFO history, none of this is new. But it talks about the story of Kenneth Arnold seeing UFOs, which happened just weeks before the Roswell crash. He spotted these 9 UFOs in Washington. And it reminded me of the experiment in 1952 by Puharik, where, remember, he was doing a seance to contact the 9, these aliens from ancient Egypt. But anyways, Kenneth Arnold sees 9 UFOs in Washington. And then listen to this. I'm going to read you from the book. So Doug Milford, he interviews Kenneth Arnold in Boise. Then he flies back to Seattle. This correspondent has located a sales receipt for a new 1947 Black Buick Roadmaster sedan purchased in a dealership outside of Seattle on July 14th. The buyer was Douglas Milford, and he paid in cash. Now, this is relevant later on. Hint, plot spoiler, he's the man in black, turns out. Then it talks about the Maury Island UFO sighting, and I'm going to read you from it. A few days before Kenneth Arnold had his encounter near Mount Rainier, an incident with even more disturbing consequences was reported to the west on the water in Puget Sound Harbor between Seattle and Tacoma near Maury Island. This is where the story of all the 1947 sightings can be said to begin and where the role of Douglas Milford starts to assume firmer shape. On June 21st, a licensed marine scavenger named Harold Dahl, his 16-year-old son Charles, and their family dog were salvaging orphan logs. A hidden menace to shipping, logging operations paid a healthy fee for their recovery from Puget Sound near Maury Island. At around 11 that morning, they noticed six round unidentified aircraft hovering in the sky above them. Alarmed, Harold Dahl immediately made for shore and observed the discs through binoculars from there, also taking a number of photographs. As reported by Paul Lance in his story that appeared the next day in Tacoma Times, Dahl described the crafts as metallic gold or silver color with a ring of six porthole windows around the perimeter. The crafts made no sound, had no visible means of propulsion, and he estimated each of them to be approximately 200 feet in diameter. So Harold Dahl then retrieves pieces of metal that was dropped by the UFOs, takes it to his supervisor, Fred Chrisman, and takes Fred to the location, gives him debris, and apparently he had a film. Fred Chrisman calls his friend Ray Palmer, who runs pulp stories called Amazing Stories. Now, if you read my book, The Dark Path, you'll know that the pulps were created by the founder of the Ordo Templi Orientis. He manufactured the papers with which pulps were printed on. And they're all, again, all connected, right? Science fiction, the supernatural, it's shown to us in fictional form. Does it manifest into reality? We'll see. So Ray Palmer, he was publishing the Amazing Stories, right? Including stories by a guy named Richard Shaver, who claimed he received wisdom or gnosis from Lemurians telepathically. And these Lemurians lived underground in these lava tubes and caves, like underneath Mount Shasta. And that's how Owl Cave is described, by the way. The Twin Peaks Owl Cave is described as lava tubes and caves and all that. And Mount Shasta, of course, has tons of paranormal activity. And there's like even a chamber area where supposedly some really dark rituals happened. And Lemurians, I mean, that's possible, right? We're talking about USOs at this point. So who knows, right? So Fred Chrisman, he was in the OSS, turns out, the predecessor to the CIA, and also claimed that he found Lemurians in caves while doing a military mission in Burma. So Fred Chrisman had already known Ray Palmer, so he mails Ray Palmer some of this UFO debris from Maury Island because he knew Ray was into this supernatural stuff. Ray Palmer then arranges for Kenneth Arnold to investigate this Maury Island thing, since Kenneth Arnold was kind of a hot topic for the UFO sighting. So Kenneth Arnold meets up with Fred Chrisman and Harold Dahl. They review the evidence, and they decide they're going to contact military intelligence. So they get a hold of Captain Davis and Lieutenant Brown, who end up flying up there. And they're all in a hotel room, and they find out that it's bugged under surveillance. So Captain Davis and Lieutenant Brown, they're like, look, be careful. There's people watching, apparently. They're going to launch an investigation. So the next morning, they fly out to go back to their base or whatever. And their plane crashes. And this really happened. This is the first Air Force casualties ever. Is two guys who were researching UFOs. Harold Dahl then was visited by a man in black. In a black Buick. Implying that that was Douglas Milford. Now, From here, Charles Dahl, Harold's son, who was also there, he disappears. And he shows up in Missoula, Montana. Missoula, Montana, which is where David Lynch was born. It's where Maddie lived in Twin Peaks, season one. And he, from Missoula, he calls his father, Harold. And he's like, hey, I'm not sure how I got here. I don't know where, how long I've been gone. And the implication is that the Men in Black made him disappear and erased his memory. So Harold, of course, becomes shook. And from here on, till the day he dies, he denies the whole thing. He says, it was a hoax. I just want to be left alone. That whole thing is true. So Kenneth Arnold's plane, he notices that it got sabotaged, but he caught it before it killed him. So some real stuff was happening over there. Now, Fred Crisman insists that the Maury Island event really did happen, and it was true. And the book, it later suggests he was what they call an extended agent of the intelligence, CIA. Fred Crisman would also be involved in the JFK assassination, because in the, you know, the movie JFK, it's about the 1977 investigation, and Fred Crisman is believed to be one of the three tramps. There's a theory that there are three shooters up on the grassy knoll. The other two were believed to be E. Howard Hunt, Frank Sturgis, and Charles Harrelson's in there. That's Woody Harrelson's father. But it's interesting because Fred Crisman was investigated and apparently looked like one of the three tramps. But this also ties us into the world of James Shelby Downard. Again, we're back in the Downard territory. Because if you recall, in the Twin Peaks primer, I talked about how Grace Zabriskie, who plays Sarah Palmer, connects into JFK and Discordianism. Because Grace Zabriskie was friends and possibly lovers with a guy named Cary Thornley. And it's rumored that her sister, Lane Kaplinger, secretly published the first copies of the Principia Discordia, which is like the Bible for this Discordian movement. And Cary Thornley, he was the co-founder of Discordianism with Greg Hill. And Discordianism is this sort of parody religion, and it's all about order and disorder both being illusions, and chaos is the only thing that reigns supreme. And within Discordianism, there was this practice called Operation Mind F, F-U-C-K, in which all conspiracies are attributed to an Illuminati, but it's all to put paranoia into society. And the question is that real? Is that what we've been experiencing this whole time? Is just paranoia? Now, Cary Thornley was in the same military unit as Lee Harvey Oswald. And in fact, he wrote a book called The Idle Warriors about his friend Lee Harvey Oswald, and published it in 1962. This was a year before the assassination of JFK. All this is very strange. You know what I mean? And David Lynch, he kind of infamously doesn't have his actors always read lines. Like, he just meets them and like gets a vibe and is like, yeah, that's cool. You fit the role. And I can't help but think that Sarah Palmer, Grace Zabriskie, is plugged into a lot of this conspiracy stuff. And of course, James Shelby Downard, who wrote The Killing of the King Ritual and all this. So back to Ray Palmer. Ray Palmer had the debris from the Maury Island thing. It gets stolen. There's another piece remaining, and they test it. It's titanium, which the book claims at the time wasn't really prevalent. And it was only after this incident that they start using titanium all over the place in rockets and missiles and all kinds of stuff. Now, another side note they bring up in the book is that Hanford, Washington is a location where plutonium was manufactured for the Manhattan Project, which was also used in the bomb dropped in Nagasaki. And the theory is that the UFO at Maury Island was just Air Force secret aircraft releasing nuclear waste, which is why it burned Harold Dahl's son and it killed the dog. And the military were actually using UFOs as cover for what they were really doing, which is Manhattan Project stuff. And the book also talks about how the military was, you know, also thinking maybe the Soviets were doing stuff. And it even talks about Eric von Daniken referencing Ezekiel. I mean, like, nothing's really changed since this book was written. It's the military acting like they don't know anything and suggestions of ancient aliens. And then you got all of us in the middle wondering what's real, you know? All right, next. Project Sign. It starts out with a great little quote from the archivist. Mysteries are as much a part of nature as sunrises. They may not yield to us, but they are freely available for all to wrestle with. The hoarding and withholding of secret knowledge is the trademark of covert societies and governments. For the purpose of concentrating power and resources within a powerful elite, the few against the many. These polarities stand in direct opposition to one another. Mysteries enliven existence. Secrets strangle it. And it talks about how secret societies are behind the scenes in the flow of information, particularly with the UFO phenomenon. And, you know, he talks about how our minds detect patterns, which is kind of what I'm talking about in my alien books. I don't even know the title of them anymore. Aliens, UFOs, and the Occult. Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. The minds detect patterns, right? What is your mind programmed to see? Is it real? It's as real as your mind tells you it is. So Doug Milford ends up being a part of Project Sign out at Wright-Patterson, and they're basically researching all these UFO sightings. Some of them happen over nuclear silos. Some of them happen at Twin Peaks. A guy named Einar Jennings saw a UFO at Twin Peaks at Sparkwood in 21. That's Hank Jennings' father. But Sparkwood in 21 is where Laura Palmer was last seen alive when she jumps off James's bike. Now, it also tells us that in 1947, Doug Milford also saw some school kids get abducted near Pearl Lakes, a location he recalled a similar event happened to him when he was younger. And this event was an abduction, and one of the children abducted was Margaret Coulson, a.k.a. the Log Lady. And when they found her, she was going on and on about owls. And another one of the boys abducted was Carl Rod, which explains why, if you listen to my Far Walk With Me episode, there's a moment in the trailer where he blanks out and he just says, I want to be left where I am. I don't want to go anywhere, or something like that. It's because he had a background of being abducted by aliens. Agent TP investigates owls and writes, okay, I found literally dozens of volumes containing theories and speculation about owls as metaphors and symbols, including one for the aforementioned Illuminati. Screen memories for aliens and abduction cases, guardians of the underworld, messengers of the subconscious, and even more outlandish hooey. There's one whacked conjecture that they show up as harbingers of some weird phenomenon I can't even figure out called reverse speech, which is supposed to offer some sort of window into the deepest parts of the unconscious. So this section of the book connects Owl Cave to aliens and UFOs and abductions. Illuminate confirm. We're confirming all the theories. Boom, one right after another. I think in my Use Your Illusion 2 book, where I talk about movies, I believe I covered The Fourth Kind, which shows us the owls connected to the alien phenomenon. And they talk here about the reverse speech, which is, of course, what happens in the Red Room and what Aleister Crowley advocates to use. And they say that the reverse speech offers a window into the deepest parts of the unconscious. Now, if you go back to my season 2 post wrap up analysis, where I tell you what everything happened up until this point from season 1 and 2, recall that I talked about how this whole experience is a ritual. David Lynch made this a ritual, and Mark Frost, I should say, made this a ritual for the initiate to revisit over and over, locked into the samsara wheel. And there's a breaking of the fourth wall in the Red Room. It's because you and I are supposed to be a part of the ritual, and we are ritualized into it. from Project Sign, we moved to Project Grudge. General Vandenberg didn't like this Project Sign conclusion. The conclusion was that, look, there's something going on out there. We need to figure it out. But Vandenberg didn't like that. That's too, you know, I don't know. That's some communist thought or something. So he started Project Grudge. Because he was very much a part of this whole thing of like, no, you got to steer the sheeple, the masses. They can't know this. They get scared. So he makes Project Grudge with the goal of being a disinformation program to debunk UFO sightings and knock down that public curiosity. You can't have the sheeple wander and just get them back on the hamster wheel, right? Meanwhile, General Nathan Twining, who was part of the Project Sign, he organizes the Majestic 12 because President Truman, Harry S. Truman, requests that he start the Majestic 12 to secretly keep investigating aliens. And what's interesting is there's an encounter called the Chiles Whitted sighting in 1948 in Montgomery, Alabama. These two commercial pilots saw this UFO. It was one of three Project Sign cases that were the convincing parts that the Project Sign finally concluded and said, you know what, there's something weird going on with these UFOs. And that is one of the cases that made its way to Vandenberg, and, you know, he of course crapped all over it, publicized it was a meteor, it's fake news, and all this stuff. And there's a documentary, I watched it on Amazon, called UFOs, The Secret History. And it actually goes over a lot of this stuff, but it alludes to an idea that the craft was flown with nuclear technology, you know, in the 1940s, which makes me think, are they saying that nuclear technology came to us by way of aliens? Anyways, Vandenberg then disbands Project Sign, makes Project Grudge. He wants to keep the people in America pacified. And he's like, we're going to start making this look like a psychological problem. Like, you see UFOs, you're crazy. Let's go with that. And from here, I mean, this is where we were. It's there's continual sightings of UFOs and green lights over nuclear sites, and Grudge is just debunking all of it. They're infiltrating Hollywood to make sure, you know, UFOs seem like some science fiction nonsense. Which maybe it is. I don't know. Okay, so. So, let's see here. So, okay, now we move on to Twin Peaks family history. And this is a fun little section. The Horns start up the Great Northern Hotel, of course, and a different hotel in the town apparently caught on fire, so the Horns' Great Northern remained as the, with no competition. Minimal competition. What, the Red Diamond Motel? No one's going there. They're going to the Great Northern. It tells us about, and I'm not going to go deep into all this because, I mean, this is a massive book. This is like 500 freaking pages here. It talks about, you want to learn more, you can check it out. How Catherine met Pete, about how Andrew met Josie, about how Andrew died in a boating accident, Hank and John Renault throwing a football game. Harry Truman was also on the football team, how he started beefing with Hank over this. It talks about how Norma and Ed first fell in love and they hooked up in high school, not Nadine. It talks about the origin of the Double R Diner as the railroad diner founded by Marty Lindstrom and his Swedish wife's family recipes for the pies. Big Ed joins the military, goes to Vietnam. He writes Norma every day, but guess what? Hank intercepts all the letters because he's a real creep. That's how he ended up stealing Norma. Hawk befriended Big Ed in Vietnam. Oh, we also find out that Big Ed's gas farm, the logo, when I talked about it on the pilot, I said, man, that sure looks like an all-seeing eye. We confirm, it's an egg. It's an egg. It's a reference to the family farm or whatever. So I was wrong about that. Hawk's family is confirmed to be part of the Nez Perce tribe. That's why he's so intuitive with the stuff. Talks about Big Ed accidentally shooting out Nadine's eye while duck hunting, and he feels guilty for it. That's why he sticks around with her. Talks about how Hank ends up in jail for that hit and run, and Ed sees, Ed sees Norma at the Double R Diner. They fall in love again. Okay, yeah, this is all catching up. Because they go through the history, then they go through the present. Talks about Dr. Jacoby and how he wrote this book called The Eye of God, Sacred Psychology in the Aboriginal Mind. And it was about him doing psychedelics, ayahuasca, mushrooms, all that stuff. He ends up seeing, or treating, I should say, Nadine. And he creates this hypothesis about how the left eye is wired to the right side of the brain, and vice versa. Well, the left eye is wired to intuition, all right? And the right eye is wired to the left brain, which is logic, okay? Well, Nadine, because she wears that eye patch over her left eye, she shut down the optic pathway to her intuitive side when her left eye goes out. Now, this is interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it makes me think of, remember how, I think it was everyone's left arm would tremble when the Black Lodge was opening up in season two, right? People's left arms would tremble. Or is it the right arm? If it's the left arm, they're saying that the left arm is attached to the right brain, which is logic. So it would make more sense if it was the right arm attached to the left brain, which is intuition. It would make more sense if it was the right arm. Maybe that doesn't work. Scratch that off the record. But David Icke talked about this. This is one of the concepts I had taken from his work years ago. His argument is that most of society were told to think logically, right? Most of us are right-handed. And he's like, that's because we're all left brain dominant. We're too logical. We're not emotional. We're not intuitive. And Dr. Jacoby, he apparently agrees with this. And he has this theory with making lenses where you've got red on the right eye and blue on the left. That's why he's wearing them in the TV show. Red suppresses activity in the left brain. The blue suppresses the activity in the right brain. And worn together, there is an experience where you integrate both sides and both sides of the brain work together. Intuition and logic. Sounds crazy, right? Now listen to Jacoby's experience doing all this stuff. He says in his book, when I opened my eyes, two things occurred. I realized that I was no longer where I thought I'd been, and at the same moment, no longer knew who I was, meaning destruction of the ego here. My vision was both clouded and somehow enhanced, and at some level, I registered that what I was seeing was not what was physically in front of me. I also knew that the veil of reality had been rent, split, or torn away, and that I was looking into a different or perhaps deeper dimension, one that either underlies ours or that coexists with it side by side, separated by the thinnest margin imaginable, one that our relatively primitive neurology prevents us from perceiving. So again, with the idea that there's interdimensional beings, multiple dimensions, that kind of thing. Accessible through drugs, which I postulated about how Laura Palmer started getting into a lot of problems with the drugs because the drugs were thinning the veil. So Andrew Packard, his death is debunked. Hank is confirmed to be part of that. He was supposed to kill Andrew, blowing up the boat. Andrew somehow knew, so he didn't get on the boat. Oh, okay, finally, here we go. And this is the only critique I have of the book is like I wanted more info about what happens between the end of season two and the start of season three. There's a 25-year gap. I need more info, but I don't get it. And that's all right. That's just Twin Peaks for you. It giveth and taketh. As you'll see in season three, there's going to be a lot of things you want to see. You ain't getting it. You ain't getting it. Okay, so at the end of season two, remember we had that bank explosion. We don't know what happened. We assume everyone's dead. That means Audrey Horne's dead. No, not Miss Twin Peaks. Not my Miss Twin Peaks, right? Here we confirm, Pete Martell, dead. Terribly tragic. We love Pete, but he's dead. Delbert Mibler, that old guy shuffling in the bank, dead. What about Audrey Horne? We find out. She's just injured. All right. The vault door somehow protected her. Even Pete Martell had shielded her a little bit because he's a great guy. But she is in critical condition after the explosion. This is from a news article like right after the explosion that's posted in the dossier. Andrew Packard also found dead. That's how they pieced the rest of his story together. we find out that the Packard sawmill actually did get shut down after the fire. Catherine eventually sells it to Ben Horn for his Ghostwood development project. So apparently that rolls forward. Catherine Martell, she shuts down. She becomes a recluse. So she's not dead, but she's out of the picture. And then our only little glimpse of Audrey. Audrey pens a letter to her dad before she went to the bank. And she apparently was calling him out for his Ghostwood plans of, you know, making shopping malls and destroying the natural environment. And what she was doing was going to the bank where Ben kept his money because she was going to expose his plans, which I didn't pick that up when I watched the show. I guess the Pine Weasel wasn't really what Ben Horn was planning on saving. And we actually don't know what the plans were because she was supposed to give them to the news at the bank. Remember, she kept bugging Delbert, like, call the news, and they never did. And the plans went up in flames, and Audrey's in critical condition. And that's it. That's all we get. That's all we get. We don't know. Hank ends up getting 25 years in prison. And just a few years later, he gets stabbed to death by a Renault sympathizer. And then they go through the Bookhouse Boys photos, which we talked about earlier. And it's interesting because Hawk's favorite book is Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail by Hunter S. Thompson. Now, this is what's interesting about that choice. As you know, Hunter S. Thompson talks about getting a drug called adrenochrome in this book. And what's adrenochrome? It's the fear from the pituitary gland, a.k.a. the Garmin-Bolgia. That is not coincidental, my friends. It's also not coincidental that Cooper's favorite book is The Commission of the JFK Assassination. Lucy's book is The Stand by Stephen King, which is also, that's about a spiritual apocalypse. It's about the end of days between good and evil. And then you got James's favorite book, which is Charlotte's Web. Come on, James. Get it together, buddy. I actually loved Charlotte's Web when I was a kid. Okay, so, and that's about all you get from the Twin Peaks catch-up, which is a bummer. That's why I was like, man, I want more. But you don't get it. You don't get more. Then they go back to Project Grudge, and this is where things get red hot. It starts with a conversation between President Nixon and L. Ron Hubbard, the naval intelligence officer who later founds the Church of Scientology. And if you've listened to my shows long enough, you probably already know where all this goes. It's 1949. L. Ron Hubbard is discharged from the military. And it talks about how L. Ron Hubbard met Jack Parsons from JPL Labs at his parsonage in Pasadena. And this is all in the book. I'm not elaborating on any of this. The book talks about Thelema, Aleister Crowley's religion. And it describes it as a group modeled after Aleister Crowley utilizing drugs and sex magic. And they even spell magic with a K. Mark Frost knew to spell magic with the K. I'm telling you, the guy knows his occult stuff. He knows it. That's why I recognize it. And I'm like, this show is the master course. And later on in the book, you read a theory about the parsonage possibly being built using lumber from Twin Peaks. Fun little mythology there. I'm sure it's not true, but hey, you never know. Jack talks about how Jack Parsons is building these alchemical elixirs and rockets. It goes through his whole background over several pages. I've talked about these ad nauseum. In fact, let me make a note. I'll put a link in the show notes. If you're like, Jack Parsons, who? I'll put a link in the show notes. It's a massively long story. I've done many episodes on him and Marjorie Cameron and all this. But the book is, this Secret History of Twin Peaks, is initiating the masses into this realm of the occult. It's steering them down the path. Jack Parsons, Aleister Crowley, sex magic, rockets, all this. It even tells you about how Jack Parsons was reciting the Ode to Pan, during rocket launches. L. Ron Hubbard talks about being in a ritual room with symbols and a statue of Pan. Agent TP in the book talks about the history of Crowley in the margins, defining Thelema as will, being in trance states, channeling info, Aleister Crowley's interest in the Book of Revelation, studying in Tibet. She even calls him a James Bond villain, which if you go deeper into that, it's because it ties us into 007, which is John Dee, another one of these intelligence assets making contact with entities and angels. It's all related. Mark Frost is literally dropping this in your lap. All the theories of the occult from season 1 and 2 are related to Crowley. As your boy I've been trying to tell you guys. And the book confirms all of it. Jack Parsons defines will in the book. Says, the power of the will is all, but without eros or agape, love and sex joined together, will is nothing but hollow patriarchal power without direction or force. What he taught us is that both forces must exist in balance. In order to stand beside God, you have to first reject the idea of God. Then and only then will you come to realize that you are God. Every man and woman is a star. And in the book, L. Ron Hubbard notices Jack Parsons is wearing the green jade ring. Jack Parsons had custody of the ring that we all know went, you know, Laura Palmer had it on. Before her, Teresa Banks had it on. Well, Jack Parsons had it too. I mean, it's amazing. Parsons talks about defying the natural order and rebelling against the limits of the real world. This is that antinomianism we talk about here. And he says, like, rockets and magic are the same thing. It's the same principle. It's pushing beyond the limits of human existence. Because rockets, they're defying gravity. Rockets and magic break the animal boundaries of space and time. He then defines alchemy as an internal process of man turning into God, which we already know. But again, this is Mark Frost's book for the masses. Parsons even says, the magician longs to see. This is from the iconic sort of Fire Walk With Me poem. It goes on to wrap up how L. Ron Hubbard and Parsons end up splitting up. Hubbard steals Parsons' girl. Parsons' life starts to fall apart. Of course, after he has the ring. He's wearing the ring. And from here, Doug Milford, he's sent to Pasadena. Now it's 1949. And Doug Milford, he writes up a report on this interview he conducts with Jack Parsons. Parsons reveals how, this is where, I mean, strap in, folks. This is where he and L. Ron Hubbard, he talks about how him and L. Ron Hubbard went out in the desert, did rituals, and saw things that men should never see, i.e. aliens. He talks about grays from Zeti Reticula. He talks about Nordics from the Dog Star. And TP, in the margins, even spells it out for the reader. He says, the Dog Star is Sirius, the planet Sirius, which is, or the star Sirius, which ties us into everything. The blazing star of Freemasonry, that is Sirius. It's what you find in all the lodges. They don't say that in the book, but I mean, when you start digging into it, you start realizing like, oh my God, like all this is connected. Parsons says that they were doing a ritual out by Roswell in the Jornada del Muerto. Again, this is James Shelby Downer territory, right? And Jack Parsons even says the Jornada del Muerto is the journey of the dead man. I read that directly from James Shelby Downer. I mean, I got to think Mark Frost read this. And it's interesting because Parsons says, that's all of us. We're all on the journey of the dead man, moving through life with our eyes closed, head down, shuffling towards the grave. Which is really, it makes me think of Eyes Wide Shut, but that's actually a very fascinating, that's what it feels like sometimes, right? Milford says, oh, that's where they tested the bomb. And Parsons replies, yeah, that's a fertile place for the working, the Babylon working. And there's no details given in the book, but there are some, but not from Parsons to Milford. At this point in the story, in the interview, a redheaded woman shows up to pick up Jack Parsons. That's Marjorie Cameron, okay? Now, in the margins, TP, Special Agent TP, says that Babylon is a reference from the Book of Revelation. And the book shows you a photo of a relic, a Sumerian relic of the goddess Babylon. And standing Babylon is standing next to an owl. It doesn't spell it out for the reader. You have to look for it. You have to see it. And then it all makes sense. But again, with the Babylon, well, we'll come back to Babylon working. Parsons talks about how they also went to the Arroyo Seco near JPL Labs to a place called the Devil's Gate. In the margins, Crowley wrote to Parsons and told him this is one of the seven gateways to hell, and the area was used for a plan to open up the gate. They're laying the idea that Jack Parsons did a ritual opening up a portal and let aliens through for the atomic bomb testing, even maybe a gateway to hell. The Babylon working is further defined as a ritual to summon into human form the spirit central to Thelema, the goddess Babylon, to bring the end of the world. I'm going to read that one more time because I need you to hear me. The Babylon working is further defined as a ritual to summon into human form the spirit central to Thelema, the goddess Babylon, to bring the end of the world. That's what I think is going on in Twin Peaks. And in the margins, TP says that Parsons may have opened the portal, which actually enabled Roswell to happen, which is a longstanding theory. Kenneth Grant talked about this in Outside the Circles of Time. We'll get there eventually in season 3, I think. It's also reported that the Babylon working resulted in Marjorie Cameron. That's what they say in the book. We already know that because you've been listening to my podcast long enough. You know this. Parsons also had an effort to open a second gate that they had found in the desert to bring across an entity he called the Moonchild. And this allegedly happened on the weekend just before the UFO incident at Roswell. And the note also says that Moonchild is a Crowley novel about black and white magicians trying to incarnate the Antichrist. So I think the idea here is that they're trying to present is that, look, there's a cult magicians playing with entities from other dimensions. You've got the end of the world. You've got entities. You've got the atomic bomb testing and UFOs and Satanists and occult magicians. And from here, Parsons has a downward spiral, loses his clearance, starts working side jobs with explosives. Now it's 1952. Milford pays another visit to Parsons. He's not doing well. And after this, Parsons dies in the explosion. Then an unknown colleague says this about Jack Parsons. He says, once a magician stands between two worlds, he's in danger of not belonging to either one of them. In the end, Jack danced too close to the flames, and it cost him his life. Now, that is part of, again, the Fire Walk With Me poem. You know what I mean? As far as I know, that's not a real quote. It's just attributed to an unknown colleague. I don't know if that's a real quote about Parsons. Moving on. We're getting closer to the end, folks. Hang in there. We're almost, I think this is the last section. Project Blue Book. So to recap, you've got these projects from the U.S. government, okay? You got Project Sign. The result from that study was that UFOs, they're weird. They're not from Earth. We got to figure it out. Then you got Project Grudge, where Vandenberg was like, no, we're going to use press and these resources to debunk all of this stuff. We want the public to be disinterested. And the result of that, the public just gets more mad and frustrated. They're like, no, we're seeing stuff. Don't tell me it's swamp gas. Secretly, you've got Majestic 12, where they're really looking into it more because Project Sign was like, dude, there's something going on. And Majestic 12 was like, yeah, we'll figure it out. Then you've got Project Blue Book, and this is more of a public campaign. Some of the Majestic 12 people started this in 1952. And our boy Doug Milford is on Project Blue Book. And it starts out where Doug Milford talks about Majestic 12 is referred to as the Wise Men. President Truman, a Freemason, is also connected to this. Later, Nixon tells us that it's Skull and Bones people, the Wise Men. Well, anyways, Doug says that the Wise Men are now part of the Other Path, and Agent TP thinks maybe it's an opposing force, like the Illuminati, which earlier she said was the Dark Path or the Black Lodge for selfishness. Another idea you could take is if you look at my books on aliens, UFOs, and the occult, we talked about the Collins Elite. All right? And this is the sort of inner Majestic 12 that was researching, thinking that this alien stuff was all demonic forces. Okay. So Doug Milford, he talks about how Eisenhower disappeared. This is in reference to that supposed meeting with the aliens. Talks about how the Nordic aliens were giving him technology in exchange for them to stop working with nuclear stuff. But then he took a deal with the gray aliens because the gray aliens were going to give us technology. And they were okay with us messing with the nukes. What they wanted was genetic sampling. They wanted human abductions. And Eisenhower was like, bet, let's do it. Now, this meeting with the aliens at Holloman Air Force Base by Alamogordo was used in Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That's what the book tells us. Now, Agent TP makes note that JFK was also interested in the UFO phenomenon when he was killed. Then we talk about the Condon Committee. They were given access to every single one of these projects. They reviewed it all, and they concluded there's nothing of scientific value, and they shouldn't research this anymore. It's a waste of time. Doug Milford, now Lieutenant Colonel, underlines this part of the passage. It says, Condon had focused solely on considering the idea of UFOs as a purely extraterrestrial phenomenon. And the connection pointed out here that we need to, and what we're talking about is how there's extraterrestrial theory and extra-dimensional theory, that aliens are either from another planet or from another dimension. And what they're saying here is that, yeah, there's we kind of don't think they're from another planet. We think they're from another dimension. Now, Edward Condon, he was a nuclear physicist, and guess what? He worked on the Manhattan Project as well. So these people are all very chummy. And from this Condon report, Project Blue Book gets canceled. Yes. And if you listen to my interview with Professor Diana Pasulka in her book, for her book Encounters, you'll know that Project Blue Book, which was ran by J. Allen Hynek, J. Allen Hynek is a prominent Rosicrucian. So there's a cult flair there. So Richard Nixon, he's pissed off about all this. Tells Milford, like, look, you're going to start your own little Majestic 12. Doug tells him, yeah, I think they're extra dimensional. And Nixon's like, bet, do it. So Doug Milford moves back to Twin Peaks, tells people he's retired, buys the news, buys the Twin Peaks Gazette, which is, of course, buying the news is controlling the, I don't know, flow of information. At a certain point, Doug Milford goes to meet Nixon in Florida, goes to Homestead Air Force Base, and he's shown a UFO and a gray alien. And this gray alien can appear and disappear. It's described traditionally as the, big black eyes and weird head. Lamb. They don't bring up Lamb in the book, but Crowley's Lamb alien that he channeled. So Nixon has his last sort of meeting with Doug. They talk about the secret program by the Wise Men, started in 1953, called Gleam, which was later in 1966 renamed Aquarius. Now, let's see. Hang on a second here, folks. Yeah, 1966, it was renamed Aquarius. But the Wise Men, they were worried that one of the regular sort of agents like Doug Milford was going to piece this all together and realize that we actually have already made contact and the government knows more than they're letting on. And supposedly there was actual crashes that happened in 1949 and 1958. And that's the one where the alien that Doug Milford saw in Florida, it was from 1958. And this is all kind of what Bob Lazar was talking about. If you follow the Bob Lazar story, which is ironic because his name is also Bob. Is that connected? I don't know. Another idea to float out there. So Wise Men, they're also calling themselves the study group or the group led by a person they name the caretaker. They claim there's 2 to 6 races of aliens. They think some of the aliens may have agendas. And Nixon wants Doug Milford to figure it all out. He says, that's up to you to find out now. I can't help you anymore from here. Captains go down with their ships. But I can tell you these things are part of something even bigger, something old and dug in. And it's been here all along, watching us. More than that, manipulating. We're also caught up with our own petty preoccupations. We can't see what's got its hands stuck up the back of our shirts. We've all been barking up the wrong tree, which, take it from me, has been their objective all along. Distract us with BS so we never see how they're really and truly effing us. Doug Milford also notes that Nixon had the green ring on his hand. Oh my goodness. So Jack Parsons to Nixon to Theresa Banks. So now it's 1983. The U.S. Air Force and the FBI's Gordon Cole, they set up this part of this sort of inner Majestic 12 group. They send Major Briggs up to Blue Pine Mountain into this top secret facility at Twin Peaks. They show a letter that Carl Rod, remember Carl Rod from Firewalk With Me, the trailer park manager, also abducted as a child. He writes a letter to the Twin Peaks Post. That's what Doug Milford renamed the Gazette. And suggests that there's these noises coming from a secret base of the Illuminati in the woods. And he talks about how the Bohemian Grove has a giant owl and this ancient Sumerian deity. And there's a secret power structure. And the town of Twin Peaks, the mayor, needs to look into this. Carl Rod was kind of right. Gordon Cole writes a letter to the mayor telling him, oh, hey, disregard all that. It's part of Ronald Reagan's Star Wars initiative that what we're doing out there in the woods. And it turns out it's the most sophisticated deep space communication system. And they're looking for aliens, basically. We then hear about Philip Jeffries, who went through Quantico with Gordon Cole in 1968. 20 years later, he disappears in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Then appears in 1989 in Philly and disappears again, which we all saw on Fire Walk With Me. We should also note that the Nazis allegedly went over to Argentina. So, is it connected? Maybe. The Log Lady news article, there's a sort of write-up about her. And it talks about how she met her husband, Sam Lanterman. And they got married by the Glastonbury Grove. They were apparently both environmentalists. But anyways, Sam, her husband, is a firefighter, fire chief, I should say. And there's this storm that lights the forest on fire. Sam goes to fight it and he dies in the woods. Somehow it burns down a bunch of the woods, but the Glastonbury Grove still stands. And she goes to the spot where he died, gets a log from a fallen Douglas fir, and that's where the log came from. She prophesies a dark age coming soon. Now, it's interesting because the article is written by Dr. Jacoby's brother, Robert. And he actually dies in 1986, and it posts his funeral flyer, and it says, services held on 11/22/1986. Again, a JFK reference. That's the day he died, 11/22. So the book details, it goes through the story of Fire Walk With Me, with the FBI visiting where Theresa Banks died. It was at Oregon, Bend, Oregon, in 1988. It details the Laura Palmer story, recaps the diary, recaps how Leland Bob killed her, takes us through Doug's marriage to Lana, and Doug Milford's death, as seen in season two. And we find out his ashes got spread near Glastonbury and Pearl Lakes, and the book starts winding down now. Now Doug's story's over. And the archivist is revealed to be Major Briggs. And we find out Doug Milford handpicked him to continue the research. There's a tape recorded conversation between Briggs and Milford. And Briggs reveals that he was in the Jesuits, so he knows the philosophy of fealty to an inner order and keeping secrets. And we find out that Briggs had a sighting. And that's how Doug picked him, because sightings are akin to a religious experience. Doug Milford tells Briggs he is now the watcher in the woods. Doug implies that he is the white rabbit initiating Briggs, and reveals that he also has three triangle markings on his arm. So Doug Milford apparently was also subjected to the phenomenon. Talks about how Laura's death changed, Briggs does, talks about how Laura's death changed everything. Especially because she was dating Bobby, his son. He said when Cooper showed up to Twin Peaks, the paranormal activity started heating up. And when that message that said Cooper, Cooper, Cooper came from the woods, Briggs took it to Milford, said, hey, there's something going on here. I think we should tell Cooper, even though he has no business really knowing. And Milford agrees. Yes, tell Cooper. So Briggs details his journey of being abducted in the woods, what we saw in, I think, season two, when he and Cooper were in the woods and he saw the light and he disappeared. Briggs says he feared the annihilation of his soul. He said, I journeyed back and forth through time, which is just like the Red Room in every UFO abduction where time ceases to exist. And from here, Briggs also gets the markings of the triangle behind his ear, as we already know. Now he joins the likes of Doug Milford, the Log Lady, Carl Rod. And he even describes it. He says, I've been chosen by this force. So Briggs goes to tell Doug about Cooper being about him being abducted and how Cooper's got to be the guy they need to bring into the fold. But Doug Milford dies. So Briggs goes back to the base. They call it the LPA. And he finds a message from Doug Milford dated March 15th, 1989. This is apparently before he died. And Doug Milford talks about how the programs that they've been working for, he has a change of heart. And he says, these are all deceptions. These are lies to the American public. And we're being used by a group that has selfish ends. The military, the government, Majestic 12, whatever. This inner group. And he says, it started long before 1947. They were here before us. They are singular, energetic, and evolved further than us, and their sense of space and time is not limited. They choose people for some reason. We don't know if we'll ever know their intentions or goals. Maybe they have good or evil intentions. Maybe they're evolving us. They may be good and evil, and our definitions mean nothing to them. We are the game to them. The owls serve a function to have us look into the darkness. So Briggs realizes that Cooper is what he calls his control, and Doug Milford would want him to follow Cooper. So he decides, I'm going to show Cooper the dossier that I got from Milford, the whole book, the whole history, all these secrets. So Briggs calls Truman. Truman tells him, look, you know, Cooper... Cooper and I were out in the woods, referring to the events of season 2, episode 22. It's like, look, Cooper and I were out in the woods. Cooper disappeared, and but now he's back and he's recovering. So Briggs is like, okay, cool. I want Cooper to recover, and when he recovers, I'm going to take him to the LPA, the secret base. I'm going to show him the dossier. I'm going to reveal everything because. Now I know Cooper's got to be involved in this. So Cooper shows up to Briggs' house. But we all know, and this is post-season two, right? But we all know that that's evil Cooper now, right? And we don't know exactly what Briggs showed evil Cooper. Briggs writes back in his journal after Cooper leaves and says, he just left. Something's wrong. The message holds the answer just as I thought. I think he's referring to the Cooper, Cooper, Cooper. But I've misinterpreted it. Protocols are in place. I must act quickly. I'm headed to the LPA alone. So apparently he did not take Cooper to the LPA. I don't know what he told him about the dossier. But at some point he realizes this is evil Cooper. And he initiates protocols. What are these protocols? I'm assuming the protocol is that if they confirm that one of these entities crosses the veil into the real world, which is what evil Cooper is, you know, that you're supposed to do these protocols and go out to the LPA and do something, which is what he does. And the dossier ends right there and it says Mayday. So something big, something terrible happened here. Something catastrophic that somebody prophesied and foresaw. Briggs recognized it. And he heads out to the LPA to conduct the protocols, whatever that means. And the book basically ends. We find out that, you know, the archivist is Major Briggs. We find out that TP is a special agent Tamara Preston, whom you meet in season 3. And the book ends with an image of an owl. And it repeats what I pointed out earlier. The owls serve a function, and that's to have us look into the darkness. And that's the initiation of the secret history of Twin Peaks. In conclusion, let's wrap it up. The Roswell incident happened, and the unit that it crashed at was one of the atomic bomb units, by the way. But the Trinity crash was actually the first UFO crash. It happened just weeks after the Trinity test in August 1945. And if you're unfamiliar with that, I did an interview with Paulo Harris, who wrote the book about it with Jacques Vallée. I'll put the link in the show notes. Because if you're not familiar with Jack Parsons or the Trinity crash, you got some homework to do. And I'm going to post the shows where we're going to make sense of all of it. We also confirmed Twin Peaks is all about the occult and magic. Michael Hoffman, the theorist, said that there was an OTO, Ordo Templi Orientis, temple consecrated near Mount Palomar. This is before it was an observatory. Because the OTO thought that the Mount Palomar was the sexual chakra of the earth. And this is where Jack Parsons would often go, because sex magic plays a role in all of this. Now, what's interesting is that Mark Frost was interviewed by, the point I bring that up is because I think that, the reason I say that is because James Shelby Downard, I think, is instrumental to understanding Twin Peaks. And James Shelby Downard knew all about the powers of this Illuminati dark group and how they understand sex magic, and they try to manipulate our world through entities and Jack Parsons and the assassination of JFK and all this. Now, Mark Frost was interviewed by a podcast, Twin Peaks The Return podcast. And he straight up tells you in the interview, he tells us how JFK was a moment that changed the world. It was a shift in perspective for him and so many others. They, because in the 50s, everyone thought they lived in Leave It to Beaver. But the reality is the world can be a violent, chaotic place. So imagine the wake-up call that is to have your president murdered live on TV. It was a turning point. It was a ritual. It was a mass ritual, much like you could argue the pandemic was a mass ritual. We all face death, and it changes the world. It really does. Frost even, he later talks about how him and his friend were researching the album cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Because they heard about Paul McCartney being dead, and they were looking for notes and clues. Well, guess who's on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's? Aleister Crowley. And that's where the book is opening up the idea that, look, all this stuff in Twin Peaks, it's more than just a soap opera. It's based on some reality here, folks. It's based on some occult symbolism, entities, nuclear testing, thinning the veil, ritual magic. It's all connected in here. And now we head to season 3. And we're going to learn more about what happened to Briggs and Cooper after the events of season 2. We'll also hear a lot more about the atomic testing, opening up the gateways, initiating sequences or protocols. And we now have the occult initiation into Jack Parsons and Aleister Crowley being part of the alien and UFO phenomenon. Long hid from the public. People don't understand it. They really don't. Nobody knows about it. Some of us do, because we're looking into this thing, but as you know, the masses, the media, everyone wants you to think all this stuff is conspiracy theory talk and, oh, it's all insane old stuff. Don't even look at it. Because most people you talk to, they don't even know who Aleister Crowley is. They don't know who Jack Parsons is. There's too much to learn to get caught up to what the occult realities of what's going on is happening here. That's why I keep saying Twin Peaks is this onion that you keep peeling it back and you find a lot of occult secrets in the center. So now hopefully you'll see why I keep harping on about how Twin Peaks is the course on occult symbolism. We're not even close to done though, folks. Season 3 is many layers deep. I've watched it twice thus far. I'm excited to deep dive on it. This is on my third view. I'm going to deep dive on this. And hopefully we can make sense of all this, or at least most of it. And then we're going to start looking at theories of what's really happening in Twin Peaks. And it's going to be a good time. So thank you for joining me in the Grey Lodge. If you're listening to this on the free feed and you're interested in taking the journey, you can still catch up. On my supporter feeds only, I drop the Grey Lodge episodes, walking through every single episode of Twin Peaks, The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, The Fire Walk With Me movie, and now The Secret History of Twin Peaks book. And the next move is to start digging into season 3. So join me and support the show. Go ad-free, unlock every bonus episode, all the greatest things in life. Thank you for your support. Stay positive.